Hey, folks, and welcome to Movie Crush. It's Chuck Bryant here once again in the hot, hot studio. I don't know if it's the heat is on or if the air is broken, but it's pretty warm in here. At any rate, this week I had Ken Jennings in of Jeopardy fame, and I don't know if Ken is tired of people saying the word Jeopardy to him or not, but let's face it, that's where he made his name as the all-time winningest dude on that show. And Ken and I got to know each other. Well, actually, this is a great time to plug his new show. I met Ken through John Roderick of the Long Winters, and they are friends in Seattle. And we're doing more shows here on the network, and had the opportunity to maybe throw my hat into the executive producer ring. So my first thought was, man, Ken Jennings needs a podcast. That guy's great. He's the real deal. So I called up John. He put me in touch with Ken. Turns out Ken wanted to do a show with John because they're pals. Flew out to Seattle, hung out with him for a bit to develop the show. And I got to tell you, it's called Omnibus, and it is so good. It basically captures exactly what I was hoping it would capture, which is to be a fly on the wall in a Ken Jennings and John Roderick conversation, because those two guys are hysterical and so smart. And it's just the best to sit around and listen to those two guys gab about stuff, about smart stuff. So it's called Omnibus, and it premieres next Thursday, December 7th. And you can even go listen to the audio trailer already right now online. And you can find that wherever you get your podcasts. Give it a listen. I know you're going to love it, especially if you're a fan of Stuff You Should Know. It is in that similar ilk of good knowledge learning, and also very funny at the same time. So anyway, executive producing that show, it's going great. When they were here in Atlanta to do some pilot recording, I said, Ken, I got to get you in here for a Movie Crush interview. And he was kind enough to say, well, heck yeah. And his favorite movie is A Hard Day's Night, the great, great Beatles movie. And I had not actually seen this. And I talk about this in the episode, weirdly, as a huge Beatles fan, somehow I have avoided their films for the most part. So I got to watch a new movie, and it's a wonderful, wonderful film, and the conversation was just fantastic. So here we go with Ken Jennings and A Hard Day's Night.
I was just reading, like, 11% of Americans go to the 11% of Americans go to the movies more once a month or more. Only like 1 in 9 Americans goes to the movies every month anymore.
Well, yeah.
But I feel like we go to a movie every week or two, and we watch a ton of movies at home.
Yeah.
My secret, we have a pretty nice, like, screen, because nowadays you can buy a projector for the same as a flat screen.
Oh, really?
So if you have a room that's the right, a wall, a blank wall anywhere in your house, get a projector.
Is that what you have?
We do. And maybe, I don't know if this is embarrassing or not, but we watch about a movie a day. That's sort of my thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I probably watch about 365 movies a year.
Oh, man, that's great. I can't wait till my daughter is
– bedtime.
Yeah, I mean, like, she watches – she already will watch a little bit of movies. And I know that, you know, 2 years old, you're not supposed to give them too much TV. But she loves it. So it's really hard to – I can't
I know
think
you're not supposed to give them screen time, but you don't understand. My daughter's really into it.
Yeah, that's basically – we're lazy, and she just gets so much joy out of watching Moana or Secret Life of Pets or these cartoon movies already. I guess you don't call them cartoon movies. What are they called? Animated films.
There you go. It's true that a movie never means as much to you as it does to you when you were a kid. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, she really digs it. So I'm just looking forward to I mean, my brother has two old his son is, I think, 19 or 20 now, and his daughter's 16. And movie night has always been like the biggest thing in their family. And he introduces them to all the – you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Jaws and all these great movies from our youth. And I just can't wait to do that with her.
It worked pretty well for a while. You know, you could tell my son's favorite movie would become Back to the Future or whatever I had just recommended.
Right.
But then they hit a certain age and, like, you recommending something is the kiss of death, you know?
Yeah. When does that happen?
For my son, it was like 13 or 14. And he's not some sullen clod. But he still, you know, will only like things he discovers on his own. And me being like, no, dude, you've got to see Jaws.
Yeah.
That would be like, oh, that's a dad movie. Apparently.
Right. Oh, man.
It's the anti-recommendation.
Yeah, you got to get clever.
That's right. Don't watch Jaws. It's so scary. It starts with a naked girl swimming.
Oh, well, that'll be a good way to get him into it.
Yeah, exactly. That's
until he sees it and goes, nah, you don't really see much.
You don't see anything. Spielberg. Spielberg doesn't have nipples.
No, he doesn't, actually. He's a nippleless man.
A lot of people don't know that. When you see him at the beach, you're like, you're just like your movies. There's no nipples there.
What? So you grew up in Seattle, but then moved to Salt Lake City, or the other way around?
It's a weirder story. Grew up in Seattle, but we moved overseas. I lived in Korea and Singapore for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And lived in Salt Lake briefly as an adult, like at the time I was on TV.
So what were your kind of formative movie-going years? Where were you?
You know, the VHS was invented. You know, at the time VCRs were invented, we were living in South Korea.
Okay.
And so, you know, everybody had the small video collection. You watch the same movies over and over again, you know. So, you know, if you had five movies, you would watch Star Wars and The Making of Thriller and, you know, whatever was on your shelf. And I think my parents were big, like, VCR pirators and copiers. So we started accumulating, you know, just hundreds of illegal, you know, with the homemade stickers.
Yeah, they were outlaws.
That say the name. Yeah, basically my parents are still wanted in several Asian countries.
So you didn't have – boy, this is exciting because I haven't had anyone – I mean, I had John Ronson who grew up in Wales, but he had – sort of the regular, I mean, whatever the equivalent of the shopping mall theater was in Cardiff.
Right.
But you're my first guest that grew up in a exotic, distant land. I mean, did they have American movies in theaters, or was it all home viewing?
Sometimes we'd go to American movies. I think at the time they would usually subtitle and not dub. So you could actually go to see, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and just ignore the subtitles. And they'd have these beautiful sort of Southeast Asian looking hand painted, really florid Bollywood looking marquees outside the theater where maybe the actors didn't quite look like themselves, but it was still beautiful work.
Yeah.
And we'd also go see movies on the army base. You know, the U.S. has a big military presence there. They'd always play the American national anthem and then the Korean national anthem, and then the movie would start.
Wow.
So you'd have to sit through a patriotic moment just to watch, you know, Meatballs or something.
That's pretty good. When did you go back to the States?
For college. So not till the early 90s.
So you did not get a 13-year-old at the mall experience.
We'd come home in the summer and, you know, you'd get dropped off the air-conditioned multiplex and watch whatever. Watch Waterworld or whatever the big summer crap movie was.
Yeah. So you did get that experience.
Yes. And those were very – and it was great. It was like a treat because we did not have multiplexes. It was like coming to a
–
it was like I felt like a Soviet emigre and, you know, get dropped off at the movie theater all day and watch a double feature of Daryl and the Goonies or whatever.
Yeah, Daryl. I don't think I ever saw that one.
He's a robot. It's D-A-R-Y-L. Yeah. He's a direct automaton robot youth life form or something. I don't know what
it is. Or something. I think you probably just nailed it.
I think the D and the A are wrong. I think it is robotic youth life form. I don't know what the D-A is.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't see that.
Because it sucked?
Oh, did it?
I think. That's my memory of it.
It's weird some of these movies that you realize got by you that by all accounts you should have seen for sure.
But if you owned it, you saw that weird movie six times. Like I've seen Cloak and Dagger with Dabney Coleman and Henry Thomas like 10 times because we owned it. So you got to watch that crap.
I love that movie. Was that crap?
Probably. There's all these movies you and I have not seen in 30 years. We don't know. Maybe Cloak and Dagger with Dabney Coleman is amazing.
I know. It's funny. Tig Notaro is in here in one of her big movies because we talked about sort of when we first got HBO. I lived kind of in the woods. I didn't live in like some big suburban neighborhood. I lived on a house in the woods with like six other houses. And we got cable very late compared to everyone else and HBO late. So I just dug into it. And she kind of had a similar experience. And her big movie was Under the Rainbow with Chevy Chase.
Is it Carrie Fisher?
Yeah. And she watched it over and over and over, even though it wasn't any good.
My grandparents got one of those giant satellite dishes, you know, in the days. And I think they eventually got a decoder when they started scrambling them. And so that was the same thing, summer days. And what weird movie are they showing 10 times? Oh, Never Say Never Again. Okay, now let's watch the West Coast feed of it as soon as it ends.
Yeah, it's amazing when you're that age, you can just consume media. And that's why I laugh about these days when everyone gets so bent out of shape about screen time and kids just sitting around.
Right. Like,
we did the exact same thing.
We're the latchkey kid generation, man.
Yeah.
That created our brains.
Like, if anything, it's better now because there's better variety in content.
Because there was no educational stuff. Like, when you were our age, you know, I guess there was Sesame Street, but then kids just plop down in front of Brady Bunch reruns and Gilligan's Island reruns.
Over and over.
Like, if I want to make my kids watch something, you know, educational, like there's 150 of them on right now.
Right.
We didn't have that.
Do you – and I know this is – I have to ask you about the – if you have any Jeopardy episodes of yourself that your kids have seen.
Yeah, my son was about 3 when it aired. So he got very into it. All summer he called me Ken Jennings instead of Dad.
Because
that's
serious?
What the announcer said.
Oh my God, that's hysterical.
He started calling
me
Ken Jennings because he was addicted to Jeopardy.
That's
but the
hysterical.
Funny thing is he forgot because he was only 3. So when I went back on like a couple years ago, like Against the Computer, for example, then my kids were very into it. They were old enough to remember.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He always wants to watch Jeopardy at home and I'm like, not Jeopardy, please. That, you know.
So you don't watch anymore?
I can't enjoy it. Like, as a fan, I hear the music and I get very tense. It's like, Daddy's off duty. Like,
your thumb just starts going
a
little wonky.
Yeah, I'm back in Nam, you know. Saigon. I can't believe I'm still in Saigon.
That's funny. So did you have cable TV and like HBO overseas or?
No.
Was that not a
never.
Thing?
I think some of my friends had some weird Asian thing called Star TV where you could get maybe MTV and some movie channel. But we never had it. We just had our shelves of VHSs ripped off from the Army base rental place.
Oh, okay. So that's what you would do. You would rent them from the Army base and deck to deck dub them.
My mom would dub them whether or not she – I think maybe even before she saw them. My wife grew up overseas too and her family did a thing where they would do the deck to deck dubbing. But her mom would always be standing there trying to bleep the bad words.
No way.
And the makeout scenes or whatever.
That's
hysterical. So she'd be like the monitor of the deck to deck and – trying to time it out. So you try to watch one of these movies and it's like
– So what would you do? Just pause the recording for a second?
Yeah, just pause the one that's recording and the other one keeps playing and then you – it's not exactly a Swiss watch.
So your movie is Hard Day's Night, A Hard Day's Night.
A Hard Day's Night, 1964.
Which I had not seen, as you know. Spoiler for everyone else, but you knew that I did not see this movie until – minutes ago, I finished it.
Which surprised me. You're a big music guy.
Well,
and I thought,
Chuck
will dig
guy.
This. Yeah, I would assume.
Yeah.
They're just part of our culture. But somehow you'd never seen it.
Well, and we talked a little bit about the Elvis movies this morning privately, but because that's how you talk about Elvis movies. Very hushed tones in dark corners. I don't know why I never – because I am a Beatles fanatic, I would even say. But – I'd never really thought about seeing the movies for some reason until now.
I think there is some assumption by people who haven't seen them that they're just cash-in schlock. Because they should have been. Like Elvis movies, you know? Like, hey, this doesn't have to be good. This has Elvis. Let's just make some cheap piece of crap.
Right.
And everybody will go see it. And the Beatles movies could have been like that. And they're all pretty good. And I think Hard Day's Night is great. Like, it has so many things about it that I love that even if the Beatles weren't in it, even if the biggest band in the world weren't in it, it would still be like – this is a classic Marx Brothers-y comedy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing that struck me was, first of all, just how beautiful that black and white looks. In 64, were they filming in color then?
Yeah, there would have been color movies, but that kind of cinema verite from an English language movie, I don't think you saw much.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you got French directors doing that stuff.
Right.
But the idea that some massive box office thing, you know, imagine if like Spice World or, you know, whatever, some Justin Bieber movie comes out and it's shot like a European art film.
Yeah.
You'd be like, what the hell?
Yeah. And that's very much what it felt like. I mean, it felt like Breathless or something.
Exactly.
The way it was shot. And who was it? Richard Lester?
Yeah. I think he was a TV director. The Beatles liked because he worked with some comedians they liked. And so I don't think maybe the guy had not even made a movie or not many at least.
Well, it was the height of Beatlemania. It's shocking to, especially as like middle-aged dudes now, to realize that these guys are like 22, 23 years old.
Like half our age.
Yeah. I mean, they were just kids.
And what's funny to remember now, I mean, you have to remember that in, you know, we live in a world where the Beatles are on statues and stamps and they're like the faces of the 20th century. They're like Mount Rushmore with Einstein and Disney and whatever. But at the time, everyone was like, these guys are a fad, you know?
Right.
These guys are a hula hoop. When is this going to – this will go away by December and my daughter will like stop screaming about the kids with the weird hair, you know? And then, you know, this movie – so the movie doesn't even have to be good, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's a surprise that anyone would try. It's like, let's put this out quick before they fade.
Uh-huh.
And then – but it's still a movie we're watching – you know, 50 years later.
Yeah, and I think that I did a little reading up on just like trivia notes and stuff. And I think United Artists even didn't care much about the movie. Apparently it was just like, this is a way we can get another album out
as
a soundtrack. and let's just put this thing together. And they were surprised that it was just a huge financial hit. It was a huge critical hit. And it really kind of blew everyone away.
Well, it seems like the Beatles, just for being young guys, really made some smart decisions. Like, I think they were the ones that wanted Richard Lester, this TV director they liked because he worked with Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
And they wanted Alan Owen, this Liverpool playwright.
Yeah.
Just because they thought he would understand their language and their jokes. Uh-huh. And you couldn't get a Southerner. You couldn't get a Londoner to right. understand that.
Ringo even has that line in there. You Southerner.
Southerner. So yeah, like I feel like they, for 20-year-olds or whatever, like they made all these really smart yeah. decisions, and then they turn out to be good actors too. That's not even fair.
Well, yeah, that was the other thing that struck me is just how funny they are. We had a conversation yesterday. Well, you're here in town. Actually, we should tell everyone you're in town, piloting a podcast with John Roderick. Called either Omnibus or The Omnibus. I'm not sure what it's going
to
be.
Definite article to be named later.
So, and I'm sort of executive producing this thing and got you guys over here. So you guys have been in town and we were hanging out and having dinner and stuff. And we were talking about humor and rock and roll and humor and music and how it's kind of not much of a thing.
Right. We were talking about Weird Al.
Yeah. Which I don't know if I want to go too deep into my feelings on Weird Al, but...
But yeah, he's a pushback against this idea that, you know, rock is not funny. And that's what's right. funny. That's what's nominally funny about Weird Al is that, you know, yeah. he's taking this very self-serious, authentic art form and adding funny lyrics about lunch meat.
Well, yeah. And I was like, yeah, rock isn't funny. It never is. Rock and roll isn't funny. But I kind of, and although the music isn't funny, I kind of forgot about the Beatles and the Monkees and what a great sense of humor these guys had.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty authentic. Like, I think Alan Owen hung out with them, if I remember right. He hung out with them mm-hmm. for weeks and sort of watched the interplay.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, said, hey, this is the movie. Because it's plotless, the movie.
Yeah. It's a week in the life of the Beatles during Beatlemania.
Right. And it's a little bit heightened, but it really is just them sort of doing what they would do, like hotel room to hotel room. And they even make jokes about that. I've been in a car yeah. in a room and a train in a room and a room in a room.
It's sort yeah.
of the unglamorous life of the world's biggest band.
That was supposedly when they you're right on, they met with Alan Owen for weeks, and that was supposedly what McCartney said their life was like. So he ended up using that as a real line in the movie.
Oh, that's something he said?
Yeah, wow, he said, you know, this is what our life is. And it really just captures that kind of like, did you ever get to see, I know we talked about when I was in Seattle, the Ron Howard documentary. Did you see that yet?
I haven't seen it yet.
Well, similarly, it captures that the Beatlemania thing, just how isolated they were. And it was just these four dudes sort of against the world from room to room to room.
And it's probably what cemented that amazing chemistry on stage and then probably also what ended them, you know?
Yeah.
No matter how good your relationship is, you spend mm-hmm. 16 hours a day with those people for – the funny thing is the Beatles were around for like – they were an international rock group for, what, 7 years?
Yeah, it's shocking.
Like, it's been like 7 years since the last, you know, Christina Aguilera record or something. You know, that's nothing today.
Yeah, I think about that fact about 10 times a year my entire life was that the Beatles went from, you know, Hard Day's Night to Let It Be and everything in between. And that just – the musical progression that they went through is insane over that amount of time.
With the busy – yeah, the schedule they kept, and they're still producing the most innovative music in the world.
Yeah.
That's really what makes me angry when it turns out they're the gifted actors and comedians too. It's like, really? You guys are also – you were the tightest rock band in the world even when you were a garage band.
Yeah.
And you're turned out to be the best songwriters of the 20th century uh-huh. and you're the Marx Brothers? Screw you.
Well, it truly was like lightning in a bottle, like the musical gods coming together to put these four dudes in a room together. That's why they are the Beatles.
I think what I reacted to in the movie as a kid, because I already liked the music. You know, I grew up with boomer parents that always had the Beatles on the turntable.
I didn't, but yeah.
Is that true? You did not. You're from the South and they were evil. Your parents were burning Beatles records when you were a kid.
No, my parents listened to like Kenny Rogers and shit like that.
My parents
Although
watched,
I do like Kenny Rogers now, to be fair.
I like how you put that in case he's listening.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Kenny. We love Islands in the Stream. My parents did watch their share of Lawrence Welk or whatever, but uh-huh. my dad had been in a band and he always had the Beatles. So it was really just the soundtrack of my childhood.
Yeah.
But watching the movie, I already knew the songs and liked the songs, but like what I reacted to as a kid watching that is just sort of the sense of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're not even watching a performance. It's
yeah.
like it seems like these people who actually are just loving every second of their lives and
yeah.
just this carefree like to me, they were adults at the time, which I don't see anymore. But it was like, these guys are adults, but they're still having this amazing lark, you know? And I really feel like that might be pretty central to how I've tried to live my life since then. It's just based on watching Hard Day's Night as a kid a million times.
Well, oh, so you saw it when you were younger?
Watched it a lot. It was a VHS we got from – I'm sure you could get Hard Day's Night at Blockbuster. But you remember how video stores sucked, right?
Yeah,
you
know, sure.
You couldn't get anything. But my grandparents lived in this little tiny Oregon backwoods town that for some reason had a great video store that didn't throw stuff away.
Uh-huh.
So you could go in and get anything. You could get old Michael Powell movies from the 40s, or you could get weird 80s, you know. You could just get anything there because they didn't throw anything away.
Yeah.
And one night we saw Hard Day's Night, and I think I watched it again the next day.
Yeah.
Because I liked it so much.
That's the way to do it when you're a kid.
Yeah, it's true. Kids can watch. Kids can rewatch anything.
You're talking about them having fun, though. Like, that really comes through. Like, it feels like 80% of that movie there is kinetic, like, moving around fast. Like, they're either running from fans or from place to place, and there are very few, like, really kind of still scenes. They're always going from place to place. And I thought it was really funny. They were always going somewhere really fast, except when they stopped to, like, talk to the ladies.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's so many scenes where they're just like, oh, well, hi, how are you?
I think there might be scenes where they leave stage right, and then they come back in and are like, hey, well, what's going on? You know, because they saw a girl out of the corner of their eye.
Which is, of course, the Monkees was very much inspired by this, and that you could tell that show just completely, I don't say ripped off, but was heavily inspired by Hard Day's Night.
The Monkees seeing Hard Day's Night and Help. Yeah, I think maybe because the pace of it is just blistering even today, that movie. And imagine in 1964 where comedies were sort of these Pink Panther-y snooze fests.
Right.
You know, the idea that this movie goes boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Maybe because there's four of them, you know, like there's always something to cut to. Oh, let's see what George is doing. Oh, he's getting up to some monkey shines.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true.
It's like how the only other quartet in comedy I can think of is the Marx Brothers before Zeppo left.
Yeah.
And those movies are also boom, boom, boom. So
yeah, that's true.
Maybe that's some comedy secret. Have four dudes.
Oh, man. We've been getting it wrong for a while.
Or ladies.
another favorite sequence was the Ringo sequence where he disappears and goes in, quote unquote, disguise in just a hat and an overcoat. But as soon as he puts those on, he's just a regular dude for the next, whatever, 12 minutes.
Yeah, Ringo gets an arc and gets to hang out with a street urchin kid, you know?
Yeah. It's really kind of cool, though. Like, it's one of the only sort of slower paced sequences in the movie. And you really get the sense that Ringo kind of needed that, you know?
I guess I had never thought about that, that it's really him, you know, getting to put on a disguise and not be Ringo for a second. It's like Henry V going and hanging out with the troops in disguise, you know? Because you never really see the Beatles regret anything about this life, you know?
No.
They're loving every second.
Yeah.
But I guess when you think about that Ringo scene, it is, you know, I guess there are some trade-offs to the pinball life.
Yeah, and he has been lauded by critics for his how forlorn he was in the riverbank scene. But apparently, I looked it up. He was extremely hungover that day, so that was supposedly why he sort of brought that to the table.
He's a good actor. I feel like maybe McCartney is the one who I don't think is as gifted an actor because he seems like he's trying very hard. He's a little hammy in the movie.
Yeah.
And that goes with everything you think you know about Paul, that he was sort of the taskmaster who always had the plan and, you know, always had the idea. And he seems like he's maybe trying a bit hard.
Well, I was going to ask you, just character-wise, even though they are playing themselves, like who did you like the best? I feel like a teenage girl.
I feel like temperamentally I'm very much a George guy. And I like the scene where there's sort of this social critique scene where these style arbiters are, you know, trying to, you know, use their wiles on George. They see him as a typical youth.
Yeah.
And he just has no time for it. He's like, bozos. But I think in the movie, John comes off very well, actually. He's always doing these sort of crazy, sort of Peter Sellers-y bits of shtick, you know. A lady holds up a measuring tape and he cuts it like he's opening a bridge. Yeah. Or, you know, he's playing around in the bathtub and doing, you know, German accents with the battleship. He's very good in it, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think John was came across as very playful and mischievous, and especially like watching it now, like knowing who these guys really were, it's kind of fun to see John, who was, you know, kind of a heavy dude in real life with what he went through in his life, and to see him just be so kind of playful, and all of them just at that age together having fun, before things got heavy and they decided, like, we can't even play shows anymore.
It's bittersweet so now to watch John be so sweet and goofy and be like, oh, heroin addiction for you in 3.5 years, buddy.
Yeah,
you know?
Like the countdown timer's coming.
I mean, not even the – yeah. And then the real countdown timer, I guess, for all of us.
You know? Oh, sure.
McCartney's still touring. Ringo's still touring, you know. But you see him today and, you know, they can't quite hit the high notes. And there's a real grace in hearing, you know, Paul's voice sort of crack now as he sings these old songs or sings about his youth.
Have you seen him lately in concert?
I saw him 3 years ago, maybe. Uh-huh. And he is still amazing. He'll carefully space out the piano song so he can sit for a while.
Sure.
But he never stops. He was on stage the whole time and it was a, 90 minute show.
Yeah. He plays a lot of songs now.
Maybe more. Maybe it was longer. Yeah. It was a long show. I could not believe how long he was playing.
Yeah. I mean, his set lists are, I mean, you see young bands go out and do like 20 songs and he's doing like 35.
Right.
It's nuts. Do you have any favorite lines from the movie that you remember? Or sequences?
Yeah, there's stuff we still say in our daily lives from that movie. I often think, you know, because I sometimes get recognized now from Jeopardy, but people aren't sure it's me because it was, it was a very vague and fleeting long ago kind of fame.
Yeah.
I often have a reenactment of the scene with John and the lady who's like, are you so him? Great. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's Anna Quayle. And I often get that too. Are you who I think you are?
Do you ever do that? Do the John?
Sometimes I do the John. Sometimes I get to do the John part, which is very exciting.
That's such a great scene. Because it could have been like just one quick exchange, but they really kind of drag it out and are playing with each other. And, that was really funny.
We often say he's a very clean old man. We say that a lot.
They said that a lot in the movie too.
I was very disappointed. I thought that was a beautiful non sequitur. And then I later found out that it's just a TV sitcom reference.
Yeah.
Cause that guy played the Fred Sanford character on the British Steptoe and Son. He's the junkyard guy. He was a dirty old man. So it's a joke. It's a running gag in the movie that this time he's a very clean old man.
They really hammer it home too.
Yeah. But I like the running gags. It's funny how they have that guy to be the troublemaker.
Uh-huh.
You know, much is made of about how the Beatles are such a force of anarchy and they're free spirits in that movie. But really, they're not rebels at all. Like, what do they want to do? They want to have the window open on the train.
Right.
Or they want to, like, they're a little late for a rehearsal because they wanted to go jump around in a field. I mean, they're not Marlon Brando-style troublemakers, you know?
No.
Like, at the time, parents were like, oh, what is up with these guys?
Right.
But we watch it now, and they're just, like, goofy. They're not rebels at all. And they put the old guy in the movie to actually make trouble and do all the things the Beatles couldn't do.
Yeah, it was funny that the Grandpa McCartney was the King Mixa of the group.
They say that, if you lived in Boston, you'd be a senior citizen of Boston. Yeah. But you're just a shabby old man from Liverpool or whatever.
Those accents are just the best.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the Beatles' appeal is just Americans being like, oh, those cute, weird accents. You know, they seem so cheeky, you know.
Uh-huh.
We have to invent words because we don't really, you know. A British person hearing that, I don't know if – I guess it's still a regional accent. Maybe they're charmed by the accent as well. But when Grandpa McCartney keeps saying, you've got your nose in a bloomin' book.
Yeah.
Because Ringo's reading Lolita or whatever he's reading.
Oh, is that what he was saying? I didn't understand because some of the stuff you literally almost need a little glossary. Just not only just the words, but some of the terms they use are lost on me. So
yeah, the stuff they say on the train in that early scene when you're not quite into the lingo yet, you're like, what are they even talking about?
Yeah, it had a bit of a train spotting effect on me at first. Right. I was like, oh my God.
That is a funny thing in movies how at the beginning of the movie, you're like, I'm not going to understand these Irish people ever in this movie. And then like 20 minutes in, your brain somehow adjusts and you get to Ireland or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, another one of my funny bits I thought that was just so kind of dumb and slapstick was the disappearing doves.
Oh, the magician?
Yeah, it just really speaks to the humor of that time. And I found myself literally laughing out loud at that part probably more than any other.
Yeah, the implication is the doves have died, right?
Yeah.
Like the feathers come out and offstage there's been this terrible act of animal violence.
Yeah, and then like he's running – it's Grandpa McCartney, King Mixer – is running by the magician and says, oh, you know, I used to see your father perform. And if you're
the music hall.
Yeah. And he slaps him
on the back.
It's just so silly. I love it though. Like, that mid 60s slapstick, there's like this purity to that kind of comedy Yeah, it definitely was from
pre-Monty Python kind of and a lot of it's non sequiturs, like, you know, the bathtub drains and John Lennon disappears somehow. Uh-huh. You know, he goes down the drain. Yeah. Well, there's a scene where George is shaving on, or I guess he shaves their manager, the road manager, on a mirror.
Yeah.
He sprays the shaving cream on the mirror and shaves him there. It only makes sense if the camera's at that one angle, you know. Yeah. It's a very silly bit. But yeah, I love that stuff. And you can totally see like a whole school of wacky British comedy sort of being created out of out of the rubble of the Goon Show and Spike Milligan and Peter Sellers.
Yeah, it's very kind of sweet to see that kind of comedy, I think, these days, like when you look back at it.
It's very innocent. When you mentioned the stage magician, I sort of forgot that, you know, in that rehearsal scene, when the Beatles are performing, they've got big insect beetles on the wall behind them.
Yeah.
But you know what? The word Beatles is never spoken in the movie.
I'd notice that.
Like, that's the confidence of that movie, uh-huh. that they never say, here's the Beatles, you girls love the Beatles, you know, the hula hoop. Like, they had the biggest fad in the world, and they never name it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they sort of show you the backstage of it, where they're not the Beatles, they're just the four lads.
Yeah, they were the lads. You see it on the drum kit, and then...
It says it on Ringo's drum.
On the helicopter at the end.
And no one ever speaks it, you know?
That giant helicopter, mid-60s giant helicopter, which was hysterical.
I guess, and the idea is that, you know, they're lifting off into the sky, but they're not really, you know, it's just all going to happen again. You know, the next day is going to be another hard day's night.
Yeah. And I think I kind of always wondered, I don't know why I never looked it up before, where that phrase came from. And supposedly that was a Ringo line when he was being interviewed or something. They were in the studio so long and he said it was a hard day to an interview or something. And then they came out and it was night. And then he said a hard day's night. And that's kind of where they got it.
Yeah, I think I've heard that Ringo is often just saying these sort of unconsciously, like, dumb, naive, but, like, brilliant, sideways little coinages, which I guess is – it probably comes from the Irish. You know, like, a lot of those Liverpool people of that era came from Irish stock who had come over a generation or two ago, and they loved the music of the language.
Right, the limericky
– Yeah, and they still sort of have that sort of sideways manner of speaking and coming at an idea.
Yeah.
And yeah, you see it a lot in the movie.
What about the other Beatles movies? Because now I feel like I'm going to dive deep.
The problem is it's a little disappointing after Hard Day's Night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I like them all. I mean, maybe not like Magical Mystery Tour. It's just a goofy TV special, which is sort of has some creepy vibe, actually.
Uh-huh.
Help is very good. Help is sort of a bigger budget color.
Right.
Hard Day's Night. But that sort of robs it of all the breathless stuff and just makes it into a Pink Panther movie. You know,
right.
there's like a caper and, you know, this weird Central Asian cult has stolen Ringo's ring and they're trying to cut off Ringo's finger. And so it's like this around the world, you know, just bigger budget, more James Bondy kind of a thing.
Why do you keep bagging on the Pink Panther? I love the Pink Panther.
This whole interview is gonna be, to me, it's just sort of the epitome of some comedy that seemed so funny in the 60s. And you watch it now and you're like, yes, she's in a bikini. You think those movies are funny today?
Yeah, I love them.
When I watch them now, they feel very slow. I think the first Pink Panther movie is like 130 minutes, and I'm like,
well, that's way too long for sure.
I'm like, that's a little long. For a comedy.
I just remember when I was a kid, Inspector Clouseau, that character, I thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen.
My wife's family loves the Pink Panther movies, and she's always quoting Inspector Clouseau. I think she'll always say a muth instead of a moth.
Uh-huh.
And
I still pull out some of those lines.
I love Peter Sellers like so much.
Yeah.
But to me, you just have to wade through so much just David Niven plot garbage in the Pink Panther movies.
That's true.
To actually get to Peter Sellers doing something funny.
Yeah. They were a little contrived plot wise for sure.
So Help is more like that. But it sounds like you'll be into that. You love flabby 60s British comedy.
Maybe that's my jam. And then what else? There's Magical Mystery Tour. Then
I love Yellow Submarine.
Oh, right. That was animated.
Yeah. Have you seen it?
No.
I think it's great because it's got this amazing Peter Mac sort of 60s art thing going on. The Beatles are not even in it. Like, they were so done with hanging out together and, you know, it's like, let's get our United Artists contract done. So it's not even their voices. And I think I've heard that then they saw the movie and were like, wait, this is actually going to be good. And we're not even in it. So there's a little live action tag where they appear.
Yeah.
But that movie's very funny and it's full of puns. The screenplay's by like Eric Siegel, who wrote Love Story and.
Oh, wow.
Like it's a weirdly literary screenplay full of like really amazing puns and a wordplay. And I love that movie almost as much as Hard Day's Night, even though it's very different.
Oh, wow.
And Let It Be is just depressing.
Yeah. Actually, I have seen Let It Be.
It's, you know, it's cringy. It's sort of difficult to watch, like, for Curb Your Enthusiasm reasons, uh-huh. except you know they are actually fighting and yeah. it's unpleasant.
Yeah, I didn't know that officially counted as a Beatles movie, so.
I think it got them out of their contract.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, like they had to make four movies, and so that's why you get this one sort of tossed-off animated movie uh-huh. that's good, and then this one documentary that's sad.
Isn't that the way?
Just like life. There is sort of the – that is sort of a little like life. You got the young exciting, innovative youth, and then the flabby middle age.
Yeah.
And then try to recapture it with a brilliantly colored cartoon, maybe make some bad choices like Magical Mystery Tour, and then finally it all goes to shit.
Well, why is it your favorite movie? Why is it your pick?
Part of it is watching it very young.
Yeah.
Like I'm very suspicious of people whose favorite movie is something they saw in their 30s or whatever. Like,
yeah.
Like really? Like how did Dead Poets Society mean so much to you at 35?
Right.
You know? Like, cause when you watch a movie as a kid, it really, that's what's forming your brain, you mm-hmm. know, like your synapses are still being created and personalities are still being formed. And it's, you know, the movies you watch are like the crucible that creates you. And so, you know, part of Hard Day's Night is just loving that music and
yeah.
the music never getting old. And maybe part of me that sort of wishes I'd actually been there for it
mm-hmm.
instead of some, you know, 80s kid listening to REM and sort of thinking,
right.
you know, like the real golden age was the 60s. Although, you know, it turned out that alternative scene was its own little golden age and we, you know, maybe I just didn't know it.
Right. The only thing we know for sure is that now is not the golden age.
Right. Now is never the golden age though, you know?
Yeah.
Like in the 80s, we were always making fun of that music and now like – now it's like, oh man, you guys had Michael Jackson.
Yeah. Good point.
So part of it's just that sort of fake nostalgia for an era I didn't really know. And I'm sure it was nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the Anglophilia of it, you know, like being able to watch sort of this funny British sensibility that seems a little exotic to me. But mostly just that it's so good and it doesn't have to be. And I've never seen a movie that has that infectious air of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it was not improvised at all. I think it's all pretty tightly scripted, but it never feels that scripted. You know, it always feels like, turn on the camera. The Beatles are doing something goofy. Look, 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 look.
Exactly.
You know, so you've got this thrill of seeing the most magnetic, charismatic people of the 20th century, you know, actually going about their day and being hilarious.
Yeah, agreed. Well, that leads us into our final couple of segments here. We, meaning me. Well, and you.
Am I part of this segment?
You are. The first part is I call What Ebert Said.
This movie is a complete disappointment.
Roger Ebert's my favorite critic of all time, and I like to always read a little bit from his review. And he gives it 4 stars, by the way.
Whew.
This is the first 4-star movie so far on Movie Crush.
Oh, really? I'm in the lead.
You're winning.
I'm winning the Ebert challenge.
And this review was obviously not from 1964, but I think it was a re-release many years later.
It was re-released to theaters in the 80s.
So he had this to say, the Beatles were already a publicity phenomenon, but they were not yet cultural icons. Many critics attended the movie and prepared to condescend, but the movie could not be dismissed. It was so joyous and original that even the early reviews acknowledged it was something special. After more than 3 decades, it is not aged and is not dated. It stands outside its time, its genre, and even rock. It is one of the great life-affirming landmarks of the movies.
Wow.
How about that?
It's not even a, you know, not even a good rock movie. It's a life-affirming landmark.
Yeah. Pretty heavy.
And I totally buy that. Like, he's just said in a better Pulitzer-winning style, like, sort of the same reaction I had. Like,
absolutely.
Like, this is not – I've never seen a rock movie like this. I've never seen another movie like mm-hmm. this. It just makes me happy.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's why he's my favorite film critic.
He's so good. R.I.P.
Yes. Have you seen that documentary?
It's very good. It's,
yeah.
You know, you really admire him as a person.
Totally.
You don't get that sense of – you get a sense of him. Like, I read a lot of his reviews, and you really do get a sense of, like, that he must have just been a mm-hmm. great open man, you know?
Yeah, agreed. And their last bit that we'll finish with here, Mr. Jennings, is 5 questions with Ken Jennings. In this case, it's just 5 questions.
It's not usually 5 questions with Ken Jennings. It'd be very odd.
And these can be – you can answer as succinctly or as long as you want. But here we go. Question number 1. What's the first movie you remember seeing in the theater?
Oh, it's easy. Dumbo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My dad was still in law school and they did cheap screenings on campus. And mm-hmm. my parents were trying to I remember them explaining, it's like watching something on TV, like watching Saturday morning cartoons, but it's going to be really big. It's a big room that has like a big TV.
They said that?
Yeah. And I'm like three and I couldn't even picture that.
Yeah.
And Dumbo's still one of my favorite movies too. We could have done Dumbo. But yeah, that was my first movie.
When did you start taking your kids to movies in the theater? Because I'm kind of curious when I should do that.
When they were babies and we thought they'd be asleep, we would just take them to random stuff. And you know, we're not monsters. We would have taken them out if they'd cried. But we could often take our kids to a late movie and we would just sit through the movie and they would sleep.
Oh, wow. That's great.
But I feel like we took them to cartoons fairly young.
Okay.
You know, there's so much – there's genuinely great cartoons now. Growing up in our age, you know, the Disney cartoons of the 70s and 80s were, you know, just Oliver and Company and, you know, they weren't good.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're in some golden age where there's like six pretty great animated movies every year.
Yeah, like my favorite still is The Jungle Book, but that was not from our childhood.
Yeah, to me, we saw those all in re-release, right? When Disney would re-put them out every 7 years, you get a new old Disney movie every summer.
Exactly.
That was a rite of passage. I used to go to every one of those.
Question two, what was your first R-rated movie?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm pretty sure it was The Untouchables, the De Palma Untouchables.
Oh, wow. Good one.
I almost think it was like some church youth thing where it was like, let's put on a movie. And the hip young youth pastory guy who was doing it was like, he almost put on like.
Which is funny because it's not a hip movie at all.
No. Well,
a good movie, but.
Right. But it was, you know, typically you would not show some De Palma movie to a group of church kids.
No.
And he was going to put on something, some comedy, like maybe Trading Places or something. And his wife was like, Rick, no boobs. And he was like, right, no boobs. So watch The Untouchables instead. You know, Bloody Death in Chicago.
Yeah. He's like, I got to put Body Double back on the shelf then, I guess.
Sorry, honey. No Body Double tonight. No blowout.
Number three, will you walk out of a bad movie? And if so, can you name one?
Like in a theater or at home?
No. Everyone stops them at home. But like, have you walked out of a movie in a theater?
No. Like, I commit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I feel like people who walk out of movies are actually like – they're weak.
Yeah.
You know, I want them culled from the herd.
Yeah.
Like, you paid your money. Like, what if the director really sticks the landing? You know, what if this turns?
Uh-huh.
And I think there's something to be learned from bad movies. Like, it's really about, you know, why didn't you like it? Like, what about you? Did you not react to that?
I agree with that.
I remember seeing Big Top Pee Wee as a kid and just being like, I love the first one and this is so bad and almost wanting to walk out.
Right.
And it's not like I stayed and learned anything. Big Top Pee Wee is pretty terrible. But
you're like, you're a kid. You're like, where am I going to go?
Exactly. My mom's not coming back for 48 minutes. And I feel like if I can stick out Big Top Pee Wee, I can stick out anything.
Yeah. My move used to be to, and I don't walk out of movies now because I so rarely get to the theater. I'd make sure it's a really good movie. You know, I don't take a chance like, oh, let me go see Demolition Man.
Yeah, that too.
Which I walked out of.
Oh, but, you did?
Yeah. My move though was to walk out of that movie and try and time it and go see something else. Yeah.
Of course, you pay it twice, though, because
otherwise,
that would be dishonest.
That's right. Number four, can you name a guilty pleasure movie that you kind of go back to?
I don't think this is a bad movie per se, but like my wife grew up watching a lot of sort of goofy comedies. Like her family loves Seems Like Old Times, the Chevy Chase Goldie Hawn thing, for example.
I love that movie.
That's not my guilty pleasure. I'm working up to him for my actual guilty pleasure movie, which is a pretty good movie. And it turned out her family watched What's Up, Doc? Like all the time. Barbara Streisand, Ryan O'Neill, you know, that sort of screwball Bogdanovich thing from the 70s. And my family also watched that a ton. And so we both come from these, you know, families that can like recite What's Up, Doc. In fact, on my first date with my now wife, at the end of the date, she said, let's not say goodbye. Let's say au revoir. And I said, no, let's say goodbye. And we realized we were doing a bit from the movie and we were like, how do you even know that?
That's,
you know,
pretty great.
What's Up, Dog, 1972.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that actually really cemented the relationship, like having the same movie tastes as somebody.
That's called a meet cute.
It's a very meet cute, but it comes from a movie with a meet cute. It's
right.
Like a meta meet cute. It's a met cute.
That's fantastic.
And so, yeah, we watched that movie a lot, even though, you know, it's not a classic or anything, but it's funny.
Yeah. All right. Number five, finally. Ken Jennings, Movie Going 101. What is your movie going ritual at the theater? Do you try to sit sort of in the same place? Do you get the same thing at the concession stand?
I'm pretty picky about seats. Like, you know, it really has to be dead center, you know, two thirds of the way back or, mm-hmm. or whatever. Like I will actually go to a different movie if I can't.
Yeah.
If you can't sit somewhere good. And nowadays that there's reserved seating, often there'll be like with these big recliner type seats. If you've got these here, like,
mm-hmm. oh yeah.
You know, there might be like three seats in the theater that actually have a good sight line, you know, so yeah. you got to get there early. I'm not a big movie snacker because I find that I just eat it all by the time the previews are over. Yeah. Like I'm not good at rationing out my snacks. There's a theater by us that'll do chocolate popcorn, and you can do half chocolate popcorn, half salty popcorn.
Whoa.
And that's sort of my go-to snack. I'm from a family of sneak snacks into movies.
Oh, me too, brother.
You grew up like that?
Oh yeah, my mom would sneak in a gallon of popped popcorn somehow.
How do you sneak in popcorn?
Large purses.
My brother to this day will do a thing where he will cough, and then as he coughs, he'll pop open his Dr. Pepper that he snuck in.
I do that too. I don't sneak in sodas anymore, but in like college when we would sneak in beer and stuff, I would do that.
Yeah.
And my friends would just open it because they didn't care. I still had that Southern Baptist boy. I was like, well, let me at least cough while I open my beer.
God will not hear if I cough.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thanks, man.
It was a pleasure, Chuck.
Really appreciate this. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that. Sit down with the great Ken Jennings. I got to tell you, Ken is just a great guy. He's so nice. And he is not at all the nerd that you think he might be. Just because he is super book smart and just because he destroys all humans on Jeopardy. Ken's actually a very cool dude. Has great taste in music and movies and just great fun to hang out with. Very funny guy. You can check him out. At Twitter, he has a really, really funny Twitter feed, actually. It's at Ken Jennings. Hopefully Ken will be going on tour with Omnibus. Or at the very least, you should check out the podcast Omnibus with the wonderful John Roderick. And really just had a good time, and I hope you enjoyed it this week on Movie Crush. And until next time, I will just be sitting here with my legs crossed because I hate having to pee during movies. Movie Crush is produced, edited, engineered, and scored by Noel Brown from our podcast studio at Pond City Market, Atlanta, Georgia.